Ajaf Fallujah? Oh, the heck with it. Damn foreigners. Why can't they all speak English? As the legendary hillbilly said, if it was good enough for our Lord, it's good enough for me. This is, of course, that Icelandic volcano that's shut down air travel all over Europe. Actually, in situations like this, I really don't need to bother. I have a handy little escape hatch. You see, I have a Chinese language resource on the premises, Chez d'Herbe, out there in the bosky suburbs of Long Island. Now, the Chinese language is all built up from monosyllables. So, when Chinese people come up against a foreign name like that, they just break it down into appropriate-sounding monosyllables. Then they stick a written character on each one, and Bob's your uncle. So, let's see what they've done with this darn volcano in Iceland. The trouble is, for one-off events like this, each Chinese news agency does it differently. There are no standards. Xinhua, the official Chicom agency, writes, Aya feya de la... Okay, got that. But then Reuters China does it as... Aya fei de la... While China News chops it all the way down to... Aya fa la... I think I'll go with that one, that's the shortest. Ayafala. Got it. Hey, pay attention in the back row there, and spit out that gum. 20 years from now, you'll all be speaking Chinese. Yes, folks, this is your implacably genial host, John Derbyshire, bringing you another edition of Radio Derb. I just thought I'd give you a little insight there into how much hard work goes into being a major news source. Now, let's go spanning the world. Yes, that volcano. If you want to look on the bright side here, I can't imagine why you would, but just suppose, the eruption of Ayafala at least has the potential to make the global warming scare look picayune by comparison. One of these science reports here, I'm actually looking at helium.com, points out that Ayafala has now had two eruptions a few days apart, and the rate of lava flow from the second eruption is 10 times that from the first. This is very bad news, as it suggests that the pressure under the volcano is still increasing. If that's so, the pressure might next fire off a much bigger volcano just 12 miles away. This bigger volcano, it's about 10 times bigger, is called Katla. Now, the last 3 times that Ayafala erupted, Katla followed suit. Cheery quote from helium.com. Quote, the past few weeks of closed airports may be just the beginning. Floods, lost farms, months of altered weather. A lot of trouble could be afoot, and not just for Iceland. Its most powerful volcanoes have been known to spew toxic gases and ash that affect Europe, North Africa, and America as well. End quote. And you still don't think we're doomed? Ha! While Ayafala's threatening our travel plans and our weather, Ayabama and his pals are threatening our pocketbooks. The most recent sign of this was an eruption of talk about VAT. That's value-added tax, basically a national sales tax. What used to cost $100 will now cost $120. The difference going to Uncle Sam. That's the long and short of it. White House economic advisor Paul Volcker started things off. Addressing the New York Historical Society earlier this month, Volcker said that a VAT was, quote, not as toxic an idea as it has been. He added that both a VAT and extra taxes on energy need to be considered. Quote from him, if at the end of the day we need to raise taxes, we should raise taxes, end quote. As that cloud of ash ascended into the atmosphere and drifted south, darkening the skies over Washington, D.C., panic began to spread among the populace. The White House tried to calm the situation, wheeling out Press Secretary Robert Gibbs and Communications Director Jen Psaki to issue flat denials that the president is giving, ever has given, or ever would give, so much as a nanosecond's thought to imposing a VAT. Then, just as the skies began to clear and international air flights were ready to resume, Obama himself went on CNBC and told an interviewer, quote,
I know that there's been a lot of talk around town lately about the value-added tax. That is something that has worked for some countries. It's something that would be novel for the United States.
The question, the interviewer, and my attention then disappeared under a lava flow of Obama-speak ambiguity. Before succumbing to the cloud of toxic gases that Obama was emitting, I caught something about reducing wasteful spending. And getting a better picture of what our options are. Oh, I think we have a pretty good picture, Mr. President. Everything we buy will cost 20% more, isn't that the picture? Or will it be 25%, as it is on some goods in Europe? You can't tax the rich anymore, or you might start losing campaign contributions. Gotta hit the middle class now, and VAT is the way to do it. Not that VAT is a terrifically bad idea. For lovers of liberty, it's a much better idea than the income tax. At this point in the calendar, in fact, almost any idea you can come up with is a better idea than the income tax. Subprime mortgages, open borders, war in Afghanistan, the space shuttle, affirmative action, liberation theology, public employee unions, another Harold and Kumar movie. Try as I might, no matter how stupid, misguided, and irrational an idea I come up with, none seems as bad as the income tax just at this moment. I didn't quite manage to get mine in under the wire this year, so I'm running an extension, with more paperwork to come. Even so, the stuff I've already filed amounts to 59 pages. 59 pages! For goodness sake! I'm married, I've got two kids, I write stuff and sell it to magazines. I have some mutual funds, my wife has an IRA, we have a home equity loan and two cars. For this, I need 59 pages of tax returns? The IRS needs to know what make and model car I bought last year? They need to know how much my phone bill was? Why? The income tax is a monstrous invasion of privacy. With a VAT, the government doesn't have to know anything about me. Furthermore, VAT is progressive, since you pay on what you buy, and rich folk buy more than poor folk. You can even rig it to be really progressive, exempting necessities like food and kids' clothes, and piling it on to yachts and Learjets. So what's not to like? If it were a choice between VAT and IRS, I'd go for VAT without hesitation. Of course, that's not what will happen. We'll get VAT and income tax. The beast must be fed, and it's up to us to feed it. You wouldn't want all those administrative assistants at the Federal Department of Administrative Assistance to have to go out and find real jobs, would you? Of course not. The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, you know, those fearless, ever-vigilant guardians of the public interest, the ones who kept such close tabs on Bernie Madoff, the SEC is suing Goldman Sachs for dirty dealing. What's this all about? Well, there are three players here. Goldman Sachs, which is an investment bank, ACA Capital, which is a bond insurer, and John Paulson, who runs a hedge fund, which is to say, a mutual fund for the carriage trade. As I'm sure you know, ordinary old residential mortgages can be bundled up into bonds and sold to investors, the homeowner's mortgage payments ending up as coupon payments to the bondholder. These bonds, in turn, can be sorted into higher risk and lower risk and bundled up into another type of bond called a CDO, with the higher risk mortgages feeding through to higher coupon payments and lower risk mortgages contrarywise. If you believed that a lot of high risk mortgages were about to default, you could short the corresponding CDOs. That is, you could sell them without having bought them yet. When the moment came that you had to buy them, they'd be worth next to nothing, the mortgages having defaulted, and you just made a killing. You see? Well, that's what John Paulson was thinking back in early 2007. He thought there were going to be a lot of defaults among high-risk mortgages. This was very smart of him, as not many people agreed. He asked Goldman to bundle up some high-risk mortgage securities into CDOs so he could short them. Goldman handed the selection of the mortgages off to ACA Capital. ACA Capital and Paulson worked together at figuring out which mortgage securities to use. When the CDOs were made up, Goldman marketed them. Paulson shorted, the mortgages defaulted, and Paulson made $1 billion. Who did he make it from? Well, mostly from ACA, which lost $900 million. Goldman themselves lost $90 million, and a German bank lost something like $150 million. These guys had bet one way, Paulson had bet the other way, and Paulson won the bet. Since ACA were involved with Paulson in picking the underlying securities, and since Paulson was a famous bear, which is to say, he was famous for betting that things would lose their value, it's hard to feel much sympathy for ACA. It is possible to feel sympathy for the German bank and other purchasers of the CDOs, depending on how much you think they knew about the background I just sketched out there. Did they know, for example, that famous bear Paulson was instrumental in setting up the CDOs? That is what the SEC case hinges on, that Goldman weren't open enough with investors about the background to the CDOs. A big fat German bank with tens of billions in assets isn't exactly a babe in the Schwarzwald, though. They have rooms full of well-paid analysts to look into the quality of securities and decide where the point of balance is between risk and reward. This is a big boy's game. I wouldn't rule out that Goldman behaved unethically, I suppose possibly even illegally, in not disclosing as much as they should have in the prospectus. But ultimately I see it as just a case of caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. A warning that applies just as much to bankers as to anyone else. I do a fair amount of grumbling about illegal immigration, which I see as just a dereliction of duty by the federal government. Politicians deliberately refusing to enforce the people's laws for fear of offending powerful lobbies and donors. This week, for a change, I'm going to grumble about legal immigration. The Department of Homeland Security has just published its yearbook of immigration numbers for fiscal year 2009. That's a bit deceptive. fiscal year 2009 actually went from October 2008 to September 2009. So you have the last 3.5 months of the Bush administration in there. It doesn't actually matter very much, as immigration-wise, the Bush and Obama administrations can be considered to be a single biological entity pursuing identical policies. That period, though, October 08 to September 09, was the trough of the Great Recession. So you'd expect the numbers of settlement visas issued to be way down, to give American citizens first shot at the dwindling number of jobs. Well, you'd expect wrong. We issued 1.13 million green cards in that fiscal year, actually a 2% increase over the year before, which was in turn a 5% increase over the year before that. Two-thirds of those settlement visas went to family unification. That is, they went not to people who were believed, on some visa officer's judgment, to have something useful to add to the United States population, but just to people who happened to have a relative living here. Which foreign country was granted the most settlement visas? Way, way out ahead of the pack. See if you can guess. I'll give you a clue.
Por el camino de México voy, enamorado de su cielo y de su luz.
That one country got nearly 15% of green cards. By contrast, the entire continent of Europe got 9.3%. Boy, this is some strange recession we have going here. For one thing, it's strictly a private sector recession. Public sector workers were actually out marching in the streets of Chicago yesterday, demanding pay hikes. A sort of million bureaucrat march. For another thing, this is a citizen recession. Americans getting laid off, while ever larger numbers of foreigners are waved in for settlement. I guess this makes sense to somebody, but it's lost on me. There's an election coming up across the pond, and the Brits have adopted the American custom of boring the electorate to death before polling day. I'll read that again. The Brits have adopted the American custom of party leaders standing up at lecterns in a row to field predictable questions from establishment media lefties. Well, to everyone's surprise, the winner of the first debate was Nicholas Clegg, leader of the Liberal Democratic Party. Far as I can tell, he won the debate on account of being the only one of the three who didn't sound like Mr. Spock on Xanax. Now, I know that the names of political parties in foreign countries can be a bit confusing. The Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, for example, is the centre-right party, sort of like the Republicans in the USA. So, how about this Liberal Democrat Party in Britain? What's the US equivalent? Listener, the US equivalent is Liberal Democrat. The British Lib Dems are multiculturalist and green. They want higher taxes to pay for more welfare state. They want closer union with Europe and more distance from those beastly warmongering Americans. Nicholas Clegg, in other words, is a sort of trim, sober Teddy Kennedy. The Liberal Democrat Party was formed 20-something years ago from a breakaway faction of the Labour Party and the old Liberal Party of Gladstone and David Lloyd George. The Labour breakaways, who at that time called themselves Social Democrats, boasted of being responsible socialists, the rest of the Labour Party having drifted so far left in the 1980s it had fallen off the edge of the known world. The liberals, at that point, had been out of power for 60 years and were sunk deep in irrelevant irresponsibility. This union of socialism and irresponsibility was originally called the Social Democrat and Liberal Party, which everyone abbreviated to SODPAL, a name which, to my deep regret, didn't stick. So here we are in 2010 with three major parties in Britain, Tories, Labour and Lib Dem. The three party leaders are all boring political wonks who have never had any lives outside politics and have never done any kind of productive work. There are differences between their parties, but you need a microscope to see them. Unfortunately, I gave my microscope to a colleague at National Review who was trying to find the GOP base of support for Michael Steele. And now. Here comes Miss Eleni with our closing selection of brief items. Item: Larry King's in a spot of bother. He's divorcing his umpteenth wife after he cheated with somebody and she cheated with somebody, and feminists are screeching at him for agreeing with an interviewee that Sarah Palin should pose for Playboy. I must admit, I never got Larry King. He's homely and ill-prepared and never asks anybody anything interesting. Yet he's got stupendously rich from his TV show, which seems to have been on forever. What's it all about? Can I have a TV show, please? I'm homely too, but at least I know the Dalai Lama isn't a Muslim. Though, to cut Larry a little slack, I think he's right about Sarah posing for Playboy. It's a terrific idea. For equal time, Nancy Pelosi could go full Monty in the Congressional Quarterly. Let's get a little spice in our politics. I suppose now that I've said that, the National Association of Screeching Man-Haters will be after me too. Bring it on. Item: here's a man after my own heart, Mark Faber, financial consultant, editor of the Gloom, Boom and Doom Report. Quote from him, appearing on CNBC, quote, "I'm ultra bearish about the world. I think we're all doomed, because the governments are taking over and they will all bankrupt us and expropriate us. But it may not happen tomorrow. They'll give us something to play with until the whole system breaks down. They'll just print money and print more money." End quote. Well, nothing much to argue with there, except how about putting me on commission, Mark? Item: some news from Iran. Actually, some pearls of wisdom from Hojat al-Islam Kazem Siddiqui, who was leading the Friday prayers in Tehran last week. Quote, "Many women who do not dress modestly lead young men astray and spread adultery in society, which increases earthquakes." End quote. So there were we, ignorant infidels, thinking it had something to do with plate tectonics. Nope, it's short skirts and halter tops. What's the line on volcanoes, I wonder? Caused by lascivious loose talk, perhaps? Tune in to this Friday's Tehran prayers to find out. Item: since I've mentioned Iran, what's little Squinty been up to lately? Well, the mighty midget's been down in southern Rhodesia. Oh, sorry, I mean Zimbabwe. Partying with Robert Mugabe. Little Squinty explained to Captain Bob how to survive the apocalypse that will follow the appearance any day now of the hidden imam. and Captain Bob showed Squinty how to reduce a prosperous, orderly, grain-exporting country into a disease-ridden wasteland populated by starving beggars and machete-wielding thugs. Just another fun encounter between two of the most esteemed and revered leaders of the Third World. No slight intended there to Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. Item, the TV show South Park ran an episode that mocked the founder of a major religion, known for its devotion to peace, tolerance, assimilation, and human values. Some adherents of that religion promptly threatened the show's writers with death. In a disgraceful display of cowardice, Comedy Central withdrew the show from its archives and bleeped out all references to that religion's founder in a following show. Shameful. Doesn't Comedy Central have the guts to stand up against this kind of intimidation? Radio Derb will never cower and tremble before these bullies, whoever they are. I really have no idea. Zoroastrians, perhaps? Oh, it was probably some kind of misunderstanding, actually. Item, quote, "We hear so many loud and angry voices in America today whose sole goal seems to be to try to keep some people as paranoid as possible and the rest of us all torn up and upset with each other. They spread hate. They leave the impression by their very words that violence is acceptable." End quote. Who said that and when? The who is not very surprising. It was Bill Clinton. Of all our presidents, surely the one with the lowest character. The when is worth noting. It was April 23rd, 1995, just 15 years ago, following the terrorist bombing of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. Clinton shamelessly, if you'll excuse the pleonasm, he shamelessly used the Oklahoma City bombing to outwit Newt Gingrich and the House Republicans. Today, Clinton's trying to draw the Tea Party movement as being in line of descent from the perpetrators of that bombing for similar low political purposes. This man is loathsome. But you knew that. Why am I even talking about this crook? What a shame on this great country that we elected him to high office twice. Item, former governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, preparing to go to trial on corruption charges, has asked the court to subpoena Barack Obama. The president, Blagojevich says, can testify that nothing went on beyond ordinary Chicago political horse trading. There was nothing actually criminal, like the blatant corruption that put Tony Rezko in jail. Remember Tony Rezko? That's the guy who was never, absolutely never, any kind of friend, neighbour or fundraiser for Barack Obama, and was most certainly never involved in any sweetheart real estate deals with him. Absolutely not. No way. There you have it, ladies and gents. Oh, here's Mandy, one of my diligent research assistants, clutching her brouillon with both hands. What do you say, Mandy?
Well, I guess it's time to go.
Yes, I guess it is.